Greetings and welcome to the third episode of the Record Business Podcast hosted by Sam Freeman. I'm the founder of the show as well as the website of the same name where I do Q&A interviews with people in the music industry. I still occasionally do those, although focus has shifted to the podcast as of this year, where it's most likely to remain. The idea behind these conversations is to get into the minds of people who have done noteworthy things in the music business, and my guest today is Michael Blair, a drummer and producer who made a name for himself in the 80s and 90s, playing alongside the likes of Lou Reed, Tom Waits, Elvis Costello, and a number of other giants of that era. He relocated to Sweden in the 90s and has been active here ever since as one of the most well-known expats in the music business. So we had a chat about his background and some of the things he's been up to for the last 40 years. Unfortunately, our conversation was cut short towards the end because Michael was called away unexpectedly by a colleague. So you might notice that the ending came a bit suddenly, but I hope that you enjoy the conversation nonetheless. Hi there, Michael.
Hello, Sam.
We meet again.
We do. Nice to be here.
From what I can tell, you grew up the son of a Navy officer and moved from home to home every year?
I did. Many, many, many moons ago, born in San Diego, California. And then, yes, Dad was a Navy officer, so we moved from coast to coast to coast. I think I moved, my mom wrote it down once, I moved 13 times by the time I was 13 with Dad, you know, being... You know, changed his billeting and moving across country and driving across country every year or two, you know, for all that time. Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't really a Navy brat. We were a little on the Democratic side of that, you know, no macho thing in our family. So it wasn't really the Navy brat kind of thing. But yes, we moved a lot.
And then the shift to the drums came from seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Sort of. I mean, yes. I mean, the big life change, of course, was like almost everybody else in my generation. Seeing the Beatles in February 1964, absolutely. I'd started playing Beatles songs and Dave Clark 5 songs and other things on the accordion before that, and I had the first Beatle album that was released on another label in like the end of 1963, and so yeah, but right about then it was like I don't think the accordion's gonna. It wasn't like a joke about an accordion being like a bad instrument, you know, like the bad accordion jokes are, you know, like what's the joke? A gentleman is someone who can play the accordion but doesn't. I mean, and then of course I turned to drums, which of course have a whole tens of thousands of jokes about being a drummer too. But yeah, I got a snare drum first and then started taking lessons at the same music store.
And from 72 to 76, I guess you were at Johnston College at Redlands?
I was. It was a tiny sort of hippie school. It was only a few hundred people. This particular school, Johnston College, it was set up in 1969 as an alternative university. There were five or six experimental schools in North America. So college level. But yeah, I mean, there were, you know, like Harvard professors in alternative religions and mind games and gestalt therapy and all kinds of other stuff. I thought I was going to read to be a psychotherapist first. And my high school guidance counselor suggested this school, which is like 2 hours north of San Diego. So I finished high school in San Diego and then went to Johnston College in Redlands, yeah.
But it seems like you were simultaneously going to University of Illinois, Urbana, from 74 to...
Yeah, I did. I mean, part of the thing in the hippie school was that you created your own curriculum, you know, with one's faculty advisor. So thinking about what was happening, I changed from psychology to percussion and music in Redlands in California. And then my teacher, though, my main advisor was an avant-garde composer. And he suggested that I go to this other school as part of my program in Redlands. So what one could do was you made your own contracts and then you sort of like applied for deals to do different kinds of projects. So I, through my composer advisor, got into this college that was one of the biggest percussion schools in the country, the University of Illinois, about two or three hours south of Chicago. It was 20 percussion majors, you know, in performance and composition and teaching.
And so you graduated in 77?
76 from Johnston College.
From Illinois?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to graduate, actually. I was working on my master's. I had gone back to Illinois. So in the Johnston College thing, I finished those requirements and graduated from there with my bachelor's, the American bachelor's degree. And then I went back to Illinois to start my master's degree in performance. But then my percussion teacher told me about an audition with a band, a world music, classical, avant-garde, improvisation, folk, world folk group called the Paul Winter Consort. They were sort of known in the States, and they toured all the time. And one of his ex-students had actually been in the band and was leaving, so he knew that there was going to be an audition. And he knew that Tom Siwi from the University of Illinois, he knew that I would really wanted to get out and play. And I was sort of the, as much as I wanted to play in orchestras and been conducting and composing and stuff, I really wanted to get on the road and play rock music. He knew that, of course. So I made the audition. I got in to this band. So I just about finished my master's, but then I moved to New York. I got the gig from the audition to play with this band. And at the time in the band, there were three percussionists, which was amazing. So playing drum set and tabla and orchestral timpani and African, big African marimbas and gigantic drums from Brazil. You know, so, you know, as a 22-year-old percussion guy, I was in heaven. It was great. So I took the gig.
Yeah, I was going to say that it seemed like you became proactive very quickly. I think that album was Common Ground.
It was. It was actually. It was the first time I'd ever been. I'd recorded with faculty members and projects in school, you know, because of, you know, American music school, you get a chance to do all kinds of stuff. But yeah, I mean, they were just finishing up the Paul Winter Consort was just finishing up that album when I came into the band. So I just played some jingle stuff and hit a couple trash cans and, you know, but I was at least on the record. And then we went on tour with that album.
And so as the sort of early 80s progresses, it seems like you pick up some credits on at least what now would be called indie bands, the TV Babies, Craig Payton Project, stuff like that. And then by 85, you're with Tom Waits.
Exactly. Boy, you did your homework. Great. Almost everybody I knew in New York from the late 70s and early 80s, everybody was in like 8 or 10 different bands. Everybody was playing avant-garde music and noise and Lower East Side, you know, punk bands and Upper East Side, you know, electric fusion bands and Greenwich Village singer-songwriter bands. Everybody was sort of playing everything in a way. It's like, why move to New York if you're not going to jump in, you know, New York City? And I met a lot of my best friends that were musicians were also working with modern dance, like choreographers and working in bands and performing live. And so a bunch of the musicians I met actually were from the dance world and the avant-garde chamber music world and the performance art world as much or more actually than the rock scene. So anyway, long story longer, there was a generation-ish of players in New York that sort of came up with that, because we were after Talking Heads, we were after the Ramones, we were younger than Blondie and Television and bands like that. And most of the bands that everybody was in didn't really break through like those bands did, like the CBGB's bands, but everybody learned how to play. So the playing level was really, really high. So I was lucky that way. And then when Tom Waits was putting an album together called Rain Dogs, I was on a list of players in New York that were worth listening to.
Interesting. And how did Tom reach out to you specifically, or did you bump into him coincidentally?
There was, it's the networking thing, isn't it? The PA, the production assistant for the album from Island Records, had heard of me. So I was on the list. It was part of her job to put that list together to give to Tom and Kathleen, his wife. And then also the engineer, the recording engineer, had worked with me on another project as well. You know, so I got recommended from two places. So I got a call, you know, from the Island Records person going, you know, Tom's going to call you and he wants you to bring in your instruments and then, you know, try recording, you know, on some stuff, because they had just started recording Rain Dogs like that day before, you know. So I was on a list and then I went in and brought all my stuff to the recording studio where they were working. And, you know, by the end of that day, I was in the band and working on the record.
And it seems that other than Rain Dogs, you played on a bunch of other Tom stuff, Frank's early years, Big Time, and even into the 90s and the 2000s with Beautiful Maladies and Orphans.
Yo, exactly. The Rain Dogs was sort of the breakthrough. And there were two or three of us from New York that came in on that album. Me and Mark Rebo, especially, the guitarist. And Ralph Carney, the saxophone player then. And so that was the core of the band with Greg Cohen, the bass player, for right Frank's Wild Years. We did that as a musical, as a theatrical musical as well, in Chicago with the Steppenwolf Theater Company. We did it first. It was after Rain Dogs and after the touring, so it was the next record for Tom. And we all met in Chicago, and he and his wife wrote a play using all the new music. And so we did that summer of 86, I think. And then after that, we recorded what was then the Frank's Wild Years album in Chicago as well.
And another one of your standout collaborators from that era was Elvis Costello. He's played on King of America in 86 and then Spike in 89.
Absolutely. Thank Tom Waits and Kathleen Brennan and the whole team again for that. Because when we were the Rain Dogs band, when we went on the road, the concerts were like sold out all the time. I mean, it was theaters and stuff. It wasn't like gigantic arenas and, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Janet Jackson kind of things. But Tom was really, really popular, especially with songwriters. You know, to get to your question, Elvis Costello was a huge Tom Waits fan. And at that point, he was living in London still, I think, then. And he loved Rain Dogs. And of course, he had heard the 70s stuff that Tom had written and was a huge fan of that, you know, songwriting, storytelling, characters, like Elvis also does. Elvis doesn't sound like Tom, but he's really melodic. He's really into places, you know, putting the listener into seeing or hearing what the character is in the song and stuff. Elvis is really, he's always been like that as a writer. So he was very respectful and admired Tom quite a bit. So anyway, long story longer again, we played in Los Angeles on the Rain Dogs tour, and he and T-Bone Burnett, who was producing King of America then, you know, came to me after the show and said, you know, that they had a recording session the next day in L.A. that they wanted me to play on, you know, for one of the songs on the King of America album. So it was a marimba thing and other things that they had thought of, you know, because of what I was doing with Tom. So I went in the next day with them and put a marimba and a noise part on. They did a cover of The Animals' Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. And that was literally the last song that they were recording for what would end up being King of America. So I played on that, and that all worked out fine, and it was really fun and inspiring, and in the headphones, you know, with the basic track, and Elvis sang, you know, the vocal that day. You know, I did my part, and then he did the vocal, and then that was that, and we had kept in touch because, you know, we were getting friendly, and yeah, so he then called me, you know, after that and said that he was, you know, working on other records, and also he was going to do a tour on the King of America album. And he put an American band together for that. That was the first time he'd had a completely American band. So I was in that. I tell my students, you know, what is it? Luck is being ready for when the opportunity shows up and that you don't blow it. You know, when you get a chance to actually be good or provide a service for somebody, when it works, then everybody's happy, and probably you get another job after that. So yeah, and then you pinch yourself afterwards going like, oh, that worked out well. I'm very grateful.
And aside from working with well-known musicians of that era, you also did some stuff with Allen Ginsberg on the Lion for Real.
I did. That was also a bit of a Tom Waits connection, because when we were making Rain Dogs in New York with Tom, a producer named Hal Wilner, who had done tribute records, like theme records, and Hal came in while we were working on Rain Dogs, and everybody who was in Tom's band then, we played on that particular track for Hal's album, his theme album for the Bertolt Brecht stuff. Lost in the Stars, that's what it was called. And then again, you know, I didn't blow it. It was fun. I started meeting new people because of Tom. So Hal Wilner, bless his soul, he died early in the COVID situation years ago. But he became really good friends and vice versa with all of us, you know, from Tom's band. And he had started using Elvis Costello on things and Tom and stuff. So I was in that circle. And then he produced the many records with Allen and many projects with Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet. But yeah, so Hal was making a record called The Lion for Real. and he put a house band together with drums and percussion and bass and guitar and horns and arrangers and stuff. We all arranged for that album. So I was on board for that. I was in the house band.
And once the early 90s comes around, and perhaps maybe what a lot of people know you for or remember you for today, other than Tom Waits, is your work with Lou Reed and on Magic and Loss.
Magic and Loss, yeah.
I've heard that he doesn't, or he didn't audition people back then, so you got in by way of calling Madonna's sister, and she got you in?
You are absolutely right. And again, it was sort of a Tom Waits, Elvis Costello, T-Bone Burnett, the producer connection, because I had worked on a record with a singer-songwriter named Joe Henry, an American singer-songwriter. And T-Bone Burnett, the producer, who I'd first met through Elvis Costello, was producing the album. So I was in the band for that album. And then, as I found out, Joe's wife, partner, still is, Melanie Ciccone. You know, they were all childhood friends in Detroit. So Joe knew Melanie and ended up marrying her. And of course, you know, knew Madonna because they were in the family. So anyway, I had heard that Lou wasn't auditioning, but he was looking for another drummer. I'd heard through other people in New York. And then I went to Melanie, who was working for one of the record labels that was connected to Lou's record label. Lou was on a record label named Sire, and Melanie was working for one of the record labels that was connected to that. So I asked Mel, I said, okay, I know that Lou doesn't audition. Would you mind calling him? Because she could call him, you know, because of the record company. And I said, you know, could you ask him if I could call him? Because I'm interested in being his next drummer. I would love to have a chance. So Melanie said, fine. And she did. And then she got a hold of me again and she said, okay, here's Lou's home phone number and he's expecting your call. So I called him. Nice, fine phone call. He was like, wow, you know, no one ever calls me, you know, for something like this. I was like, hello, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then by the end of the conversation, he said, well, okay, you know, I've heard of you, you know, roof, 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 but, you know, send me a cassette of things. So I did. And it was Waits stuff and Costello stuff and Allen Ginsberg music for his poems and pretty useful music. But then he listened to it and he called me back and he said, there wasn't anything on the tape that really excited him for the kind of drummer that he wanted for his next band. So it was like, you know, thank you, but no thank you. And I was like, oh, okay, it's New York. I tried. You know, Lou was on my bucket list and I gave it a shot. You know, so at least I got a chance. And then shortly thereafter, I was in the studio with Scott Litt, who was the, at the time, he was R.E.M.'s producer. And I had worked with R.E.M. before. They were also Tom Waits fans and Elvis Costello fans. You know, so I had met R.E.M. and U2 and bands like that through Waits and Elvis and stuff and T-Bone. Once you're in the family, everybody starts to meet everybody, which is wonderful for me, you know, for a freelance musician. It was great. So the replacements were just about to fire their drummer, but the drummer didn't know. It's one of those like horrible stories that you didn't really want to say at the time, but I was really happy and grateful to be called, you know, because there were a bunch of drum tracks that they wanted to replace, is what I'm saying. So I ended up being a replacement. The band was called The Replacements, and they were on the same record label as Lou. So long story longer, Lou heard that I was playing drums on this album, and they were like a solid hardcore rock band, you know, from Minneapolis in the States. And this was going to be, you know, a big major label, you know, do, and really good people interest, you know, on it. And, you know, John Cale played, you know, viola from, you know, the Velvet Underground, and other people, you know, Los Lobos's, you know, saxophone player was on it as well, you know. So I got called in, but I was supposed to be like the mystery drummer, because they hadn't told the other drummer yet. Think about it now. It's like, well, this happened to me as well. I've been hired and fired so many times. But anyway, this time I was hired. And long story longer, as usual, Lou asked Scott Litt, the REM producer, if he could come to the studio and listen to the drum tracks that I had played on. And right after that, he called me. I was working on another record at another studio. And he found me and called me and he said, that's it, you're in. You know, so Lou called me and said that the drumming on The Replacements record was exactly what he was looking for his next record. So from an opportunity to a no, to another record that was connected to him and a producer that he knew, and getting that recommendation to then getting into Lou's band. So sometimes it works out fine.
Indeed. What's that story you told me before about him being a stickler for punctuality?
Oh, right. We were either rehearsing for the album or rehearsing for the Magic and Lost tour, but it was in New York, and we were set up at a rehearsal and storage company. So that's where the band rehearsals were. And there was one day that I'll never forget that I tried to go to the bank in New York before I went to rehearsal, and which was silly, of course, because everything takes forever in New York, and there's the subways and there are lines, and because it's millions and millions of people. So I almost made it. I walked into the rehearsal room 1 minute, literally 1 minute over start time. And everybody was there, you know, everything was set up. My drum kit was there, blah, 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 blah. We're all ready to go. Lou looks up at me and says, "We got to go outside. I got to talk to you." And I was like, oh man, I'm going to get slammed for this. And he did. He just like laid right into me. But as the person who was paying me to be in his band, the person he was counting on everybody in the band and the crew to be on time and ready and prepared every single time. You know, it was his music. It was his money. He wasn't being an asshole to me at all. He was being a boss. And he just laid it down. He laid down the law and he said, "This can't happen. There's too much on my mind and it's new music. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure for the new project." And he really got extremely upset. Oh, and another thing that I tell my students also about networking and respect and stuff is that when we went into the hallway at this rehearsal place, I on purpose sat lower than him. He was sitting on a road case, you know, so he was up a little higher. So I found a chair and sat down. It was almost like getting interviewed, you know, for a talk show. You know, David Letterman always sat a little higher, you know, just like a teeny bit. There's that sort of like authority thing, friendly authority kind of dealy. So I did the same thing. So he talked to me, but I was a little lower than he was, and I did that on purpose because I wanted him to tell me what he needed to tell me. But then when he was sort of done in a way, I said, "Well, this will never happen again. And if you said, you know, what you needed to say, you know, let's get back to work. You know, let's go." And his mood immediately changed, and we got up and went to work. And he never yelled at me again. Well, he didn't have to.
Right, right.
For one, I was never late for anything ever again.
And the album was great.
Well, thanks. I mean, it was like 14 songs and completely new lyrics and stories about life and death and friends of his in New York, you know, that he had lost. And so, yeah, I mean, I really like playing with storytellers. So I was very, again, thankful and grateful that I could be in the band when he was writing that well.
Last thing about drumming. How many times have you been featured or mentioned in Modern Drummer magazine? Because it seems like 50 times between like 88 and 2018.
Yeah, it's something like that. I sort of broke through with Waits in a way when the magazine people and critics and people from Modern Drummer and Musician magazine at the time and Rolling Stone, you know, the critics and the journalists and stuff knew that I was playing with Waits and playing with Costello and stuff because of the records and the credits and the tours and stuff like that. So I was lucky. I mean, I'm good. I know what I'm doing, but I was also fortunate, you know, to be heard by people that wrote about those artists. So yeah, I mean, and then after being mentioned in Modern Drummer a few times, I got to know the editors of it. And then because I've got ideas about sound and listening and being prepared and working in a band and collaboration and things like that. So I asked if I could write some articles, you know, for Modern Drummer as well. And they said yes. So I started writing articles too.
Very cool. In terms of coming to Sweden, I've seen some mention of the first time being in the 70s, but what most people here say is the 80s. When did you first come over here?
First time I was here was 1985. So it was the 80s. And it was the Rain Dogs tour. We played Gothenburg and Stockholm here. And at Konserthuset, you know, with Waits. So the Rain Dogs tour came to Sweden in 1985.
You eventually settled here, which kind of made me wonder, because you were on tour with Tom and you toured with other well-known acts afterwards and
right,
making thousands of dollars a week as a touring musician.
Right.
Why would you opt to come to Sweden where you'd have to start your networking all over again? And
good question. Well, love. I'm a love refugee, another ex-New York musician falling in love with a Swedish person. So I had met the woman who ended up being my partner, wife later, in the summer of 87 in New York. And we had some mutual friends because she had lived there before. And so at a gig where I was playing in this little band in Greenwich Village, she came to the show. So we met, and then she was on vacation, semester. And then a few months later, I was here with Waits again in Stockholm. We came back to Sweden on the Frankswald Years tour, and I had three concerts in Stockholm that week, and because it was a small theater. It was like a 1,000-person theater. So we had three shows in a row that week. So she came and got me, basically. I mean, I was going to contact her anyway because I was like, wow, this person is like ridiculously wonderful and beautiful and amazing and smart, and I'm back here and like, let's go. And she felt the same, actually. So I was very, very lucky. So the good news was I still had a flat in the Lower East Side in New York City. So I kept that. And I would go back and forth and back and forth, you know, between here and there, like on the first visas, you know, where I could stay here for a while and then go back to New York and then come here and then go back to New York. And I was making records in L.A. and London anyway, you know, so I would come here in between. I mean, we were a couple, like, right away. It's almost 36 years now. So the thing about that particular thing was I started getting known, you know, the producers and some of the players and the journalists in Sweden also had heard of me and knew I was playing. You know, so I started getting hired for some stuff here as well, you know, doing sessions, and I was the music director for a TV show, and so I started getting some good gigs. But Lena and I got married in 91. We had our daughter early 94. And just before that, I got my person number, the Swedish Social Security number. And then, I was a full-time resident. I still would travel, you know, for work. You know, go back to New York or go to L.A. or London or Paris or something, you know, if I was lucky enough to get called for stuff. But yeah, it's a struggle, not just for me, but for a lot of musicians who don't come from Sweden, you know, and not because of disrespect really, but I think a lot of musicians understand that the market here is very small. You know, it's not a very big country, although the amount of talent is just gigantic, you know, compared to the number of people. But like any city or any place, there's a serious period of sort of like getting worked in and accepted, you know, or not, you know, for whatever reason. But for love and for being with Lena and starting a family, I mean, absolutely Stockholm, no question about it.
And speaking of getting acclimated, it seems like once you did get established in the 90s, you were one of the earlier people at Playground in the late 90s, early 2000s.
I was, actually. I knew John Cloud and Lars Tengroth and the other people that were working at a record label called M&W. And I produced a couple bands for them in the 90s, and partially because John was also an American from California, so we met, we were introduced.
You both went to Redlands, by the way.
We did, right? He went to Riverside, right? And he was a radio guy, and so we were like, you know, we were what, a few miles away from each other, and then we met here. Absolutely, yeah, we're Southern California boys. We actually took a trip together to Southern California, and I met his family, his other family and stuff. So it was, yeah, that was very sweet. And John was very great to me, you know, bringing me in for projects and stuff as well, you know, for production and playing and stuff. And then, yeah, so when M&W changed leadership and then the Playground record label started, John brought me in to be sort of like his assistant, you know, with international projects. So yeah, I spent a few years working with John at Playground. Absolutely. It was wonderful to work in a new record label, you know, that was guiding and supporting new talent in Sweden. Absolutely.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Michael. This has been a nice conversation.
Well, wonderful. Thanks, Sam.